Today on Maine Calling, lessons in the layers beneath us. What can scientists learn about Earth's history by studying the layers of rocks under our feet? As it turns out, a lot, and even more every day as new technologies develop. What they're finding is that many of Earth's rocks were formed hundreds of millions of years ago, some billions of years ago, from a time even before oxygen in our atmosphere. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we learn more about the history of this planet we inhabit. A new book by Maine-based author Laura Popick explores the past 4.5 billion years through the clues trapped in Earth's crust. Popick and two Maine-based geologists join us to share recent discoveries and knowledge about the geology of Maine and beyond. Maine Calling is just ahead.
Maine Calling is made possible in part by Rennie's, a Maine shopping adventure with 19 locations across the state, now open in Bangor and Waterville, and by Maine Seacoast Mission, delivering health care, education, and support to islands and coastal Down East communities. Learn more at seacoastmission.org.
I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Geologists are like detectives. The rock layers they study reveal clues to read Earth's deepest history. Today, we'll hear about what the rocks teach us about our past and our future, and we will find out a little bit about Maine's geologic makeup. Joining me for the hour, Laura Popick, who is a science journalist and the author of the brand new book, Strata, Stories from Deep Time. Douglas Reusch, who is professor of geology with the Division of Natural Sciences at the University of Maine Farmington, and Amber Whitaker, senior geologist with the Maine Geological Survey, part of the Maine Department of Agriculture, Conservation, and Forestry. We invite you to join the conversation. What do you want to know about geology, about the rock layers in Maine? Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org. Post a comment on Facebook or Instagram or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Welcome to all of you, and I'm so interested in this topic, Laura. Your wonderful new book, Strata, comes out today. This is your pub day. Congratulations.
Thank you so much. This is a wonderful way to celebrate.
You know, it's quite a feat taking billions of years of Earth's formation and making sense of it through the study of geology. I understand you fell in love with geology as a student at Bates. Was there a certain moment or discovery that hooked you?
Yeah, that is correct. I was a Bates geology student. And I think it was, I just want to shout out to my wonderful professors there who, one of whom is still teaching there, Bev Johnson, and the others have since retired. But they just did such a wonderful job helping us fall in love with the field of geology and getting out in the field and getting to know the state as a place with this layered past. And I don't think that there was one moment. I think it was just the accumulation of experiences over those 4 years that really instilled this deep love and appreciation in me.
But you write that you really took that first class just as a way to, you know, have field trips for class.
That's right. And I had a high school teacher who knew Mike Rattel, who is a professor at Bates. He's since retired, and he recommended that I take a geology class. So I kind of stumbled into that first class thinking I'll try it out, but wasn't sure how it would really sit with me. But I just really did find myself falling in love with it in that first class.
Well, one of the overriding themes in your book, as you walk us through 4.5 billion years, is that it takes a lot of detective work on the part of scientists to figure out this history from the deep, deep past, and that so much of what they're learning, and this was new to me, is brand new knowledge, that every year we're learning things we didn't know before. And I'm wondering if you can give us an example of how a new technology has led to an important new piece of knowledge about Earth.
Sure. Yeah. So one of the four sections that I write about in my book, one of the four kind of moments in deep time is the rise of oxygen in the atmosphere, which turns out to be a really difficult thing to study because oxygen that is currently in today's atmosphere kind of overwrites minerals from the time before oxygen arose. And I'll back up and just give a spoiler from the book that oxygen didn't really start filling the atmosphere fully until more than halfway through Earth's existence. So there's all this time where there wasn't oxygen, and now there is. And so there, all that's to say is that it takes some real technique to look at minerals real closely to see how they've been overprinted by oxygen now and in the past. And so there have been these ways of looking super closely at really minuscule minerals to find the oxygen history within them. So that's just one example of technology that's come out really in the past decade and a half, I think, that has allowed folks to take an even closer look at this moment.
Well, Doug, let's talk about the rocks in Maine. I think most people know about the fact that the glaciers were here during the Ice Age and they carved up Maine and they left huge boulders. You could walk in the woods and come across something ginormous. But rock, Maine has rock formations that are really far older than those from the Ice Age. How old are the oldest layers of rock in Maine that you have seen, and where are they?
So Laura has actually written about this in Down East. Back in 2014, we knew that there were old rocks on Islesboro that date back to over half a billion. But I convinced John Slack, as a Farmington resident, retired U.S. Geological Survey, and the age of rocks in Islesboro should be roughly the same time as these famous glaciations called Snowball Earth. So we went out there, and that turned out to be kind of a dead end. But John had a little extra money and took a few samples. And there's a relatively new technique where you find a sandstone and smash it up. Most of the sand grains are going to be quartz, but a few of them are a mineral called zircon, which has trace amounts of uranium, which decays to lead. So you can date hundreds of these zircon grains. So one of the samples, the first talk I gave was called Surprisesboro because we never expected it, had no zircons younger than 1.8 billion years ago. So that generated a fair bit of interest. Tentatively have matched those rocks with similar ones in West Africa. So that technique, grinding up sandstones, picking out the zircon sand grains and dating them, has really revolutionized sedimentary geology.
1.8 billion years ago. So some of the islands in Penobscot Bay take us way back. How come it is that some of these really, really old rocks are something that you can pick up on an island in Penobscot Bay, whereas I'm guessing, Doug, and you'll know I'm no scientist by the way I talk about this, somewhere else they're buried deep beneath the earth.
Yeah, those are the oldest ones in Maine. The rest of Maine is more like half a billion or less. Maybe Amber can shed some light on that.
Sure, Amber.
Doug, so I would say, so the rocks in Maine have been affected by many different geologic events throughout time. And so I did read the book, but I can't remember, Laura, if you introduced the term orogeny, but a mountain building event geologists like to call an orogeny. The rocks in Maine have been involved directly in at least four and impacted by an additional two. And so what that does is it starts uplifting rocks and putting different rocks together. And then over time, the rocks that are on top erode. And of course, if we're talking about half a billion years or 400 million years, that's a lot of time for everything on top to get worn away by glaciers or rivers or wind and rain and freeze thaw and all of that goes out into the ocean and starts to expose these older layers that are underneath.
Okay, so we know about Penobscot Bay having really, really old rock. Doug, I want to pick up on a little something you said, and you were talking about similar materials in Africa. The reason for that is because we think, don't we, that the northeastern part of the United States, including Maine, at one point in the distant past, bordered what is now Morocco, correct?
Right. If you take out the Atlantic Ocean and fit the pieces of the puzzle back together, Cape Cod would have been adjacent to Morocco. And another group of geologists independently found similar results. They, Meg Thompson at Wellesley College, Sandra Barr at Katy University, they found an old drill hole in the just offshore of Cape Cod. And the drillers must have fallen asleep because they cored into bedrock. They got their hands on this sample and got essentially the same age pattern that we got from Islesboro. So theirs is pretty easy to explain because it's simply a piece of Morocco left behind when the Atlantic Ocean started to open. It's a little more difficult to explain Islesboro because it's fault bounded. We're still not sure how those old rocks got to where they are today.
And Laura, Doug says, we're still not sure. And this is something you've found over and over and over when you're talking with scientists. Yes, they've made incredible discoveries, but there's still so much they don't know. Can you characterize sort of where we are in the scientific knowledge about Earth's strata?
Yeah, absolutely. I think this is a really exciting time, and I'll be curious to hear from Doug and Amber on this as well. But in my mind, we're still very early on in our understanding of Earth history. To put in perspective, like how far we've come, even just from the middle of last century, we've only ha really agreed on plate tectonics since the 1960s. So that's super recent. And I kind of had that realization recently where my parents, who were born in the 50s, were born into a world that didn't really agree on plate tectonics. So that is kind of like the simple mechanics of how the Earth works. And similarly, the ability to date rocks, to age them, came about in the middle of last century. And so all of these pieces, understanding how the Earth works and how to date the different pieces of the Earth, are all necessary to understand the stories in the Earth. And so those tools really came about last century, and now we're kind of getting into the finer and finer details that will allow us to parse these stories even more. But there's still so much error in our understanding of the ages, which turns out to matter when you're trying to piece together a narrative. You need to know what comes before something else, to know kind of cause, reaction, all of that. So, it's a really exciting time, in my opinion.
Amber, do you agree with Laura that this is a really exciting time to be in geology?
I think it's always exciting to be in geology, personally, but yes, as our understanding of the way the Earth works grows, as our technology develops, we can look back at the work that geologists did before they accepted plate tectonics, and we can try to reinterpret it. And there's also, so especially in Maine, the whole state has been mapped, meaning a geologist walked out there and looked at a rock and, made some observations and interpretations. The whole state was mapped at low detail, but there are still rocks that kind of were never seen. And so at the survey, what we do is we have a detailed mapping program, and we employ geologists like Doug. Doug works with us, like for example on the Islesboro map. So geologists go out and look at the rocks that, maybe no geologist has looked at before, and using all of our current knowledge can make observations and reinterpretations. So we're always finding new things in Maine geology. I find bedrock mapping to be really exciting. Myself and my colleagues continually find new things in the rocks, or we get to date them and we find, that age is not what we thought. So that can be really fun.
Doug, you're grinning ear to ear. Amber talks about these maps. I was looking at a USGS map this morning, and I noticed that it's sort of dominated by three colors. Most of Maine was a light purple. Parts of western Maine were a dark purple, on the coast a green. And Douglas, you Maine Farmington, so I'm guessing that you are in the dark purple area. What makes your part of Maine special?
So I think you're talking about the surficial geological map, which tells the super fascinating story of the recent glaciation and its aftermath. And
Ah.
In Farmington, we are right at the old beach. The Gulf of Maine used to extend here. That's
The old
University.
beach. You're on the coast of Maine in Farmington.
Right. And there would have been whales swimming around away from the beach. Anybody gets an automatic A if they find a whalebone. But you can follow this marine limit southward and over to the east. It goes all the way up to Millinocket. And it's because the weight of the last glacier had depressed the land significantly. So for a short time, the Gulf of Maine extended to where I'm sitting right now. Actually, right about here. I can't see the hand.
So he held his hand up to his chin. So when we're talking about that, Laura, we're not really even talking about what your book's about. That's all sort of recent history, right? And you were talking about the four sections of your book. You were talking about the oxygen, the ice, the mud, and the and the part that most of Maine is would fall into, most of what's been discovered in Maine is the era or the epoch that's labeled mud. Explain that.
Yeah, and so there are rocks of all different ages in Maine, but a lot of the rocks that we encounter, at least like in Casco Bay and in other parts of Maine, and I'll let Doug and Amber weigh in, fall within the kind of Ordovician, Silurian, Devonian periods, which are a time in Earth history hundreds of millions of years ago when the very first plants started arriving on land. And so, to put in perspective, this happened hundreds of millions of years ago, but in the span of Earth history, it's actually like more than 90% of Earth history transpired before plants came on. So it's actually like pretty recent in Earth history. So once plants arrived on land during this time, that's kind of expressed in the rocks in Maine. There was something on land for clays and silts to cling to for really the first time, and that allowed mud to accumulate on land for the first time. So that's not to say that there wasn't mud before this. There was. It just most of it, the idea is that most of it would kind of flow into the ocean through rivers. And now there is something for the mud to cling to on the banks of those rivers. And all of a sudden you have mud flats and floodplains, and those are places that life loves to live. And so it really was this important moment where life proliferated along the banks of these rivers. And so we have that kind of that memory preserved in the rocks in Casco Bay and elsewhere throughout Maine.
When you talk about the rocks in Casco Bay, Laura, I'm wondering, I'm thinking about some of the rocks in places like Harpswell and Cape Elizabeth, where you see these stripes in the rocks. How do you look at those stripes?
I love seeing a layered rock, obviously. I just wrote a book called Strata. So those are strata. They are layers in rock. And so each of them is kind of a layer in that case of this ancient sea floor. And so some and they've also been metamorphosed. They're not like a perfect
Not a
expression
perfect
of.
record, right?
Yeah, exactly. Thank you. But they've still been preserved well enough that you can see those layers, and you can think that could have been literally that layer might be an afternoon, 300 whatever, however many millions of years ago, and then maybe a big storm might come along and drop a bunch more sediment, and that could be another layer. You can never know for sure how much time is preserved in the layer, but just knowing that they are these physical remnants of these ancient periods just brings me a lot of joy.
Doug?
Well, so we have this awesome field site in our backyard, Bald Mountain Saddleback Wind. And at first, everybody was mesmerized by the stripes alternating gray and dark gray and light gray rock. But there are a few distinctive layers, one of which I actually nicknamed the stripes. And ultimately, we were able to recognize these distinctive layers and trace them all the way up the mountain. They're folded, and what was really cool is the stripes had been initially recognized at the bottom, but about halfway up there was a triplet. The stripes is a triplet. So a triplet, and adjacent to it is another triplet. And I wondered for years which one is the stripes. And it turns out they are both the stripes. They have been repeated by faulting. So that was a real eureka moment based on understanding the strata and the unique strata.
Amber, did you want to add to that?
Oh, sure. Actually, I was thinking, Laura mentioned that some of those stripes could be an afternoon, and I wanted to say that the processes that form those stripes are, of course, still occurring today, off the coast in the ocean. So they're basically underwater landslides, and so debris will come down off the continental shelf and get all mixed up in the water, and then to make those stripes, the kind of heavier, coarser grains, which are usually sand, settle out first because they're heavier, but the mud stays in the water a little bit longer and settles out afterwards. And so you get these basically two stripes. I mean, they're gradational, but so you've got the heavy stuff at the bottom and then the mud at the top. And so that was a landslide. That little couplet was one landslide. And then it just kept happening and kept happening. And so a lot of the rocks along Casco Bay, but also all throughout central Maine, have those same characteristics of things that are happening today. So we can see those processes in action.
Well, we are talking about Maine's geology, Earth's deep history on Maine Calling today. Give us a call with your questions, 1-800-399-3566. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. We're learning all about geology and how it tells the stories how the Earth formed into what we know today and what you might see in Maine's rock layers. My guest today, Professor of Geology Doug Roisch with UMaine Farmington, Senior Geologist Amber Whitaker with the Maine Geological Survey, and science writer and Laura Popick. Her new book, just released today, is called Strata: Stories from Deep Time. We invite you to join the conversation. Have you ever been a rock hound? Are you interested in rock formations in Maine? What do you want to know? Send an email to talk@mainepublic.org or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Joining us now is Bob Gastaldo, who is Emeritus Professor of Geology at Colby College. Thanks so much for calling in.
Oh, my pleasure.
We are linking Maine's geology to that of Earth's history, and I understand the first reported land plants were found in rocks in Baxter State Park. Tell us about that find and why it's significant.
Absolutely. So in the mid-1950s, there were several geologists mapping the area, and they came across what looked like pieces of plant material, except that plants were not supposed to be on land at that point in time in the Middle Devonian. Those samples were taken and brought to the laboratory and pondered over and pondered over and pondered over. And ultimately, it was realized by Henry Andrew and his group that these were some of the earliest land plants that didn't have any real characters or features that we normally think of plants living today. And in the mid-1960s, 1970s, there was an intensive amount of work done in Baxter State Park to collect along Trouton Brook and the rocks associated with Trout Brook. And his group of students and colleagues had identified these knee-high, ankle-high, potentially waist-high plants that had just colonized the mud flats of an ancient estuary that was adjacent to and developed from the Traveler Mountain sediments as that volcanic terrain had eroded and went to the oceans.
Wow.
In
Bob,
addition
how
to those
old?
early land plants,
I was going to ask you what's the estimate on how old those were?
We're looking at something about 320 million years, excuse me, 420 million years old. And since then, we've found older plants in different parts of the world. But this was the first breakthrough with the Baxter State Park material.
Fascinating. Also in Baxter State Park, you recently reported on fossil charcoal in the park. Why is that significant?
Charcoal needs three things to form. The first of all, of course, is plant debris, right? Biomass. The second is some type of ignition, which in the deep past is not, or as the cartoon has, why do the dinosaurs die out, right? They're smoking cigarettes with a lighter. Yeah, there are no lighters, there are no matches. But lightning is certainly the principal driver of fire, as we now know and continue to know. But you need a certain percentage of oxygen in the atmosphere before fire can be propagated. And due with the experimental work that was done in Britain a couple 20 years ago, the lowest level of oxygen in the atmosphere that will allow for propagation, ignition, it might smolder below that level, but above that level, fire will take off, is 16%. Mm. We now have about 21% oxygen in the atmosphere, which means that, as we all know recently, the wildfires in Canada have just gone crazy, and we're reaping the unfortunate benefits of the smoke. But in order for fire to have occurred on land, we had to have at least 16% oxygen in the atmosphere. And that didn't happen until the Silurian. Ian Glasspool and I published a paper a couple of years ago pushing that 16% back about 10 million years into the middle early Silurian.
Well, Bob, thank you so much for calling in. It's so interesting that our own Baxter State Park is the site of two really important discoveries that change the way we think about geology. Bob Gastaldo, Emeritus Professor of Geology at Colby College, and he's talking, Laura, about what you write a lot about, which is this idea of Earth, most of the history of Earth in a time before oxygen, which frankly is kind of hard to get one's head around, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is. And I think it's something that I like to just take into my day to day when I'm out on a dog walk and taking a breath, think like, wow, this is pretty recent that we can even do this, let alone bodies with legs and lungs and all of that. But yeah, it really shifts the way you see the world.
Tell us about, well, I have you talking about oxygen, the great oxygenation, is it catastrophe? I didn't write this down. I'm just trying to remember.
Yeah. So it's, sometimes it's called that. Called
the oxygen catastrophe. Yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah. But the idea is that when oxygen did finally arise around 2.4 billion years ago, give or take a couple hundred million years, it was really bad for a lot of life. The idea is that it was toxic. It was really hard to deal with. When we think of the antioxidants that we try to eat today, we're protecting ourselves from that toxicity of oxygen. And we've evolved to deal with that at this point. But when it first kind of started accumulating in the atmosphere, life wouldn't have had those adaptations. Even the life that created the oxygen may have suffered from the oxygen. They had to evolve ways to survive it. So, yeah, the idea is that there was maybe a mass extinction that came with the rise of oxygen, but it's hard to know that for sure because anything that lived then would have been kind of too smushy and gushy. It would have been bacteria that wouldn't have left behind really good fossils. So it's hard to know for sure, but that's what folks think based on what they know about what oxygen does to life.
We'll go to Patty calling from Portland. Hi, Patty, go ahead.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
Oh, good. I'm in the car. So my question is, coming to more recent times, that have the scientists and experts on this program conferred with or worked with any of the Wabanaki traditional knowledge keeper folks who know a lot of their own understanding of Maine and the term used time immemorial changes that come from the traditional knowledge base. Have any of these folks worked with them or explored their knowledge?
Sure. I know this is something you thought a lot about, Laura, while you were writing the book. I know from reading the book. But Doug and Amber, what would you like to say? Doug, go ahead.
Teresa Secor is a Farmington resident, and she is Wabanaki and did a degree in geology. So I think that is a yes to your question.
Okay, Patty, thanks for asking it. We have a few emails coming in. Facebook posts. This is Marianne on Facebook. Can you comment on the story of the upturned layers in what looks like non-sedimentary intrusions by the Pemaquid Lighthouse? So, Amber or Doug, are you familiar with the area around the Pemaquid Lighthouse and what's going on there?
Yeah, absolutely. So a lot of that are those sedimentary layers. But of course, when we think about that, those sediments settling out of the ocean, they should be flat when that happens, right? They should be horizontal. And they were initially. But when we have mountain building events, and we've gone through, as I said, several, we start to tilt rocks and fold rocks and break and fault rocks. And so at some point during all of that action, then those layers were tilted on their side. And so a lot of the ones there are what we would say metasedimentary, so metamorphic rocks that were once sedimentary rocks that were tilted. But then, yeah, at Pemaquid, we have a lot of rocks that were made that were once molten and that cooled once they intruded the rock, so an igneous rock. And a lot there are granite and pegmatite, like the newly coined main state rock, granitic pegmatite, that just happened recently. So you can go there to see some of that. So the igneous rock would be later, and some of it probably happened before the tilting, and some of it may have happened after the tilting. And there's evidence that a lot of happened before a lot of that deformation, and it was deformed along with those layers.
Jeff on Facebook asks, what's the age of the yellow clay layer in Steuben, Maine, about 7 miles from ocean inland? Approximate elevation here is 100 feet. Are fossils above, below, or within this clay? Also, please explain Jasper rocks, Jasper beach rocks. Beautiful. Who wants to take this one?
I guess I can. So I'm not a surficial geologist. I don't study the clay layers. I definitely have colleagues here that would answer that better, so maybe I won't even try. But I can talk about Jasper Beach. That is one of my favorite places in Maine. My family and I visit quite frequently. So it's not Jasper. And if you go, especially at low tide, to Jasper Beach in Machiasport, you can walk over to the cliffs where the rock is eroding. And that's actually a volcanic rock, mostly a rock we call rhyolite. But it's purple and red and has little bits of other crystals in it. And when it breaks off the cliff, you can see it's all blocky and rectangular. But you'll notice if you look at it that it's the same as all the beautiful smooth rocks on the beach. And so, of course, those are beach processes where those rocks get eroded off and then tumbled in the waves to those beautiful smooth rocks that we all love to sit on at Jasper Beach.
We'll go to Marilyn calling from Holton. Hi, Marilyn. Go ahead.
Thank you for taking my call. My question is, because I live up here in the county, we have what's called potato rock, and many potato farmers because of the soil. I would like to know when the potato rock was formed, the erosion that may have occurred, and all of its properties. Thank you.
I saw you smile, Laura, but I'll go to you, Doug.
I think you're referring to the limestone that's also present in limestone that makes for great soils. And we have it all the way down through central Maine. We have a little bit in Farmington, actually. So its age is Silurian, roughly 430 million years old. And there's an idea that at that time in the Gulf of St. Lawrence in Quebec, there was a limestone reef. And this reef shed limey mud that was transported south all across Maine. And today it makes for great soils. That would be my interpretation.
That's a great question, Marilyn. And thank you, Doug, for that answer. We are going to take another quick break. We're talking about Maine's geology, and we're doing so to celebrate Laura Popick's new book, Strata, Stories from Deep Time. What are your questions? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. If you're quick, you can send a brief email, talk@mainepublic.org, or find us on social media. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Today, we are talking about the lessons in the rocks under our feet, the strata the lessons about the long history of planet Earth. Joining me today, Amber Whitaker with Maine Geological Survey, Laura Popick, who is author of the new book Strata, and Professor Doug Roisch with UMaine Farmington. You can share your comments and questions very quickly with email talk@mainepublic.org. You can also post on Facebook or Instagram or call 1-800-399-3566. But Amber, before we move on to more calls and things like that, the Maine Geologic Survey, if somebody's listening right now and thinking this is really interesting, I'd like to learn more, or listening and thinking, wow, I'm so confused, how can I learn more? Where would you recommend they go?
Yeah, thanks. So our website, and if you can just Google Maine Geological Survey, and that should be the first result that comes up, has a whole bunch of information, and it's fairly, I would hope, easy to navigate. There is a search bar that you can just type in whatever topic you're looking for. But in particular, I wanted to say that we have a series called Geologic Facts and Localities. And the link to that is on the right-hand side in the popular topics box on our website. And those are mostly short, written for public consumption descriptions of sites in Maine where you could go to see something geologically interesting. And so I know that Jasper Beach is represented there. Pemaquid is also represented there. But you can bring up a map. You can zoom in to where you might be going that day and click and download and even print a little geologic field trip for yourself.
Wonderful. Well, calling in now is Maggie Krunke, who is Director of Retail and Visitor Services at the Maine Mineral and Gem Museum in Bethel. Thanks for calling in, Maggie.
Well, thanks for having me.
I understand you are celebrating an anniversary this year and that there's something pretty big coming up right around the corner.
Yes, on Saturday, we're celebrating our fifth anniversary. As many people know, we opened December 12th, 2019, and we won't talk about what happened in 2020, but we thought we'd throw a celebration of our five-year anniversary. So Saturday, we're having hands-on learning activities for kids. We're having our sluice open. All activities are free for the day, free admission for all visitors all weekend. Sunday is free admission for Maine residents only. So, yeah, big things happening at the museum this weekend.
Well, thank you so much, Maggie, and congratulations. And I will tell you, it is one of my favorite places to send people. What a beautiful gem, pardon the pun, of a museum you have in Bethel.
Oh, thank you so much. We're pretty proud of what we have here. You know, we've seen 82,000 visitors over the last 5 years. So we figure we've got a lot to celebrate.
You do. Maggie Krunke with the Maine Mineral and Gem Museum. So many calls coming in. I have no idea how many we'll be able to get to, but we will try. We'll go to Ellery calling from Waterville. Hi, Ellery. Go ahead.
Yes, I've been having a grand time with this program. Thank you very much. We've been hearing a good deal about sedimentary rock, the crust rust that I like to talk about. But we've got some volcanoes in Maine. I love volcanoes. What influence did volcanoes, and mixed along with nearby the fossil corals north and west of Millinocket? Volcanoes are such an amazing thing, and to find fossil corals not far away, it's just confusing. And what part did they play?
Oh, boy. Doug, I'm calling on you.
Well, there are several volcanic belts in the state. There's Katahdin, which was a huge caldera. And then there's the coastal volcanic belt, which is a string of calderas from Vinyl Haven, Idaho, Mount Desert Island that extends all the way into Canada. The age of that is roughly 420 million years ago. Right around the time of one of the period boundaries, as if perhaps that volcanism, it's not my idea and it's very speculative, might have had something to do with the biological changes that took place between the two time periods, the Silurian and the Devonian. Yeah, all in all, there are maybe half a dozen separate volcanic belts ranging in age from Cambrian, that's about 500 million in the Ellsworth area, and then up to northern Maine, where they're a little bit younger.
Ellery, thanks so much for the question. We're going to move to David calling from Brooklyn. Hi, David. Go ahead.
Hi, I'm calling to see if you can give me an explanation of the phenomenon known as snowball Earth, and when it was, how it happened, and how anything could have survived that condition.
Well, Laura, an entire section of your book is ice, so I'm going to turn to you for this one.
Yeah, thanks for the question. So yeah, one of the four sections is all about this period called snowball Earth, and there were actually multiple times that are thought to have been periods of snowball Earth when the idea is that the entire planet would have been covered in ice from the poles down to the equator. And we think that because there's evidence of glacial kind of drop stones, so random rocks that couldn't have got into ocean sediments anyway other than an iceberg dropping it. We find them in rocks that are known to be from the equator. So that means you have ice in the tropics. And if there's ice in the tropics, then there's ice everywhere else on Earth. And so there are some rocks of roughly this age in Maine, and there's still a lot to be to learn and to parse out about these periods. But your question about how life persisted through these times is a great one. And the idea is that there would still be some cracks in the ice and that algae and bacteria can live in those cracks in the ocean. They can live on top of the ice in ponds, as bacteria and algae do on top of ice in Greenland today. So it wouldn't have been easy, but they did make it through. And then at the end of the last snowball Earth glaciation, relatively soon after, in geologic terms, we get this explosion of life and the very first real animals widespread across the planet. So if you read the book, you'll learn a little bit about those connections and how the snowball Earth events may have actually helped catapult the planet into this multicellular planet full of animal life as we know it today.
Thanks, David, for the question. We will go to Kirsty calling from Jonesport. Hi, Kirsty. Go ahead.
Hi, I'm up in Jonesport, and I have been trying to get a geologist to answer this question or take a look for a long time. I'm so excited. I have a really large, I think, glacial erratic right in front of my house called Balanced Rock. It's right on the edge of the water. It's on like three sharp points, and it's about 15 feet tall. It has kind of a sister rock, which is Bubble Rock, on the side of a mountain in Acadia National Park. And I don't think a geologist has ever seen this amazing rock of mine.
So are you hoping someone will come out and look at it, Kirsty? Is that what you're saying?
I would love that.
Amber, how does somebody find out more about something unusual in their neighborhood?
Yeah, so the Maine Geological Survey is here for you. We work for the people of Maine. You're welcome to give us a call or send an email if you're more comfortable with that. And someone can get back to you with more information. I mean, it sounds like you are correct in identifying it as an erratic, assuming that the rock underneath it is a different rock. And so I don't know that we don't have anyone currently mapping in that area, but it can always be of interest. So yeah, give us a call or send us an email. And anyone should do that if they have geologic questions.
Yeah. All right. Well, Kirsty, thank you. Yeah, go ahead, Doug.
Amber, do you want to mention the Ice Age Trail that I think goes pretty...
Oh, go ahead. Jones, yeah, Valley. I think it does.
There's a beautiful publication that Hal Borns at Orono initiated a number of years ago. And you start in Bar Harbor and head to New Brunswick, and it has all kinds of the story of the Ice Age, basically. It's a great publication, and it's available online.
Yeah, wonderful. Finding a web address for you.
Yeah, I will put a link to that in the Maine Calling newsletter. Let's see here. We'll go to Tony calling from Poland. Hi, Tony. Go ahead.
Hi there. Great program today. I was wondering if your panel could discuss the formation of pegmatites and how important they were to the economy in Maine.
Well, thank you, Tony. And if you haven't been to the Maine Gem and Mineral Museum that we just heard from, I would recommend that. Who wants to talk about pegmatites?
Yeah, I can. Jennifer, you're right. Go to the museum. They have a lot on pegmatites, and they're doing active research on pegmatites. So you can certainly learn a lot more there. But yeah, so it was recently spearheaded by staff at the museum in Bethel to assign granitic pegmatite as the main state rock. So we've had a main state mineral for quite some time. Everyone, I'm sure, knows it's tourmaline. But pegmatite is found almost everywhere in Maine. And if you if you're not familiar with it, it's a rock that kind of often looks very white. It has a mineral called feldspar in it that's usually quite blocky and can be really big. And then quartz, which is often smoky, but of course we also find gem quartz like amethyst in pegmatites. And then usually something else. So micas that could be dark or light colored, garnets, tourmaline, of course, is found in the main state rock. And so we do find many different things that have been important. And gosh, I could go on forever, and this is a short show, but in general, they are formed from molten rock, but it's different from granite. It probably had a lot of fluid in it, and that fluid could be water. And so the minerals were given the chance to grow quite big because of that combination. And so that's why we get those really big minerals that we can dig out in pegmatites. But because we find them in a lot of places in Maine and they contain that mineral feldspar, feldspar was quarried in many places just by hand, by small operators, and then sold to be, I believe it's the ceramics and porcelain that was shipped down into New Jersey, I think. So that was a really important export for Maine and an important source of income for people. And you can see those pits everywhere. If you go to Bradbury Mountain State Park, for instance, there's a pit there.
Tony, thanks so much for your question. Before we run out of time, Laura, I want to talk to you about some of the, you know, insights that you gathered as you traveled the world talking with these scientists and thinking about deep time. And one thing that you're thinking about again and again is the place we are today and the climate crisis and the uncertainty that we're all facing. I'm going to read just a couple sentences. You write, by pushing ourselves to the edge of crisis, we have found ourselves nose to nose with our origins. Our planet seems to be telling us to take a look back and to remember how unlikely each of our lives is, and yet here we are. It's so interesting because you find some comfort by looking back hundreds of millions and billions of years.
Absolutely. Yeah, thank you. So yeah, I think that we can find comfort in the fact that we're not going into the future blind. We have 4.5 billion years of history behind us that can show us how the Earth reacts to different types of change. And so while the current climate crisis and other environmental crises and just all sorts of turmoil across the planet demands our attention and our care, we can pause at times and remember, okay, well, what can we, what like actual lessons can we learn from the past to feel that we're on this long trajectory, that this moment will pass, that we're so lucky to be here, and that the Earth often will find a way back to some sort of stability. And that doesn't kind of get us off the hook. It doesn't mean that we get to give up. And it means the opposite, that we have agency to help the planet back to a stable state, while also just like appreciating how incredible this place is, all that it's been through, and how unlikely it is that we get to be here. And so why not really make the most of our time here by caring for this place that supports us?
Do you feel like this is an insight that you had working on the book, or did you have conversations with scientists around the world who are feeling this way as well?
Yeah, this was something that came up in conversations over and over again. So scientists shared this with me, and I loved hearing it from them, because it's one thing for an author, a nature writer, to say this. Of course, you know, I feel this way, but to hear it from the scientists themselves, they might not get to express that in their scientific papers. Some do, which is great. But to be able to have them voice that within the book felt really important.
Well, I really appreciate the book. It's called Strata, Stories from Deep Time. The author is Laura Popick. I also really appreciate you, Doug Roisch and Amber Whitaker, for joining us today. Again, Laura Popick, a science writer with a background in geology. Doug Roisch is professor of geology at UMaine Farmington, and Amber Whitaker, a senior geologist with the Maine Geological Survey. Today's sound engineer was Sam Tracy. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Tomorrow on the program, we're going to get an update on how Maine is doing with broadband connectivity. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you have been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.